Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Hey, good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm well. I'm always well. Well. Well, we just found a well.
Right. You were talking this morning about a product that you brought to my attention, this article, because mm-hmm. you knew to get me angry, and that always adds a little positive.
The madder
energy to
the Francis
show.
Is, the more energy the show has.
Okay, look.
Here's so I poke the bear in the morning sometimes.
here's the deal. Pork. Pork is really good food. It's not the other white meat. It's red meat. And pork has been bred to be the other white meat. Pork, the fat has been bred out of pork. Sadly, the flavor has been bred out of pork. And the way to produce pork cheaply is to be really mean to the pigs and have them live in disgusting agribusiness pork.
I think we should stop doing that.
What they call containment farms. There's a move, and you can go to Heritage Foods USA to find out where you can buy real pork. And, you know, forget the Save the Whales vibe that the show occasionally gets. If you want pork that tastes, I don't know, 3,700 times better than the pork you find in your supermarket.
And it's better for you. It just simply is.
Oh, and it's also, right, and it's also better for you, better for the pig, better for the planet. But it also tastes like something. Now, look, I grew up, my mom used to put the pork chop under the broiler about 2 in the afternoon. We'd eat at 6.
Sorry.
Put a can of sauerkraut on top of it. So I never realized how great pork could taste. And the pork that our grandparents ate was different than the pork we have today.
That's true.
Now, let me read to you.
We're about to tell you how different it was.
From Newhouse News Service. They've realized, they went on this low cholesterol thing, reduced the agribusiness, went on this, reduced the fat in pork. And so they've bred pigs that are easy to torture and keep in confinement barns and that have very little fat. And they become the other white meat. Problem is, they bred out the flavor.
That does hurt sales sometimes.
So now we have a situation where your pork, when you get it in the market, will be labeled probably all natural pork or enhanced pork. Anytime anybody tells
enhanced.
You something,
it's better than it was before. It's
yeah,
enhanced.
I don't think so. Here's what enhanced pork is all about: all natural pork or all natural chicken or all natural turkey has to be fresh meat that's not been injected or marinated. Enhanced pork and poultry, as a matter of fact, has been injected with a solution of water or broth, salt, sodium phosphate, and some breads also include other preservatives, flavorings, and antioxidants. They shoot it with salt water.
So you don't have to pay for the salt water?
No, you got to pay for the salt water. See, that's the ticket. If you have 7% salt water shoved into your flavorless pork chop to give it a little bit of flavor,
then you pay 7% more for your pork chop.
Right on. Okay.
But that's one of the ways that they keep the price down.
The pork industry has a long list of reasons for using additives, but one of its biggest is that pork has been bred to be much leaner than the meats our parents and grandparents enjoyed. Fat provides moisture and flavor to meat, and that means that really lean pork will be dry and tough, even if it's slightly overcooked. Enhanced pork will still be moist if it's overcooked, just like it were natural pork.
Right.
Beautiful. It'll
be moist with the salt that you in salt water that you injected into.
Sounds like a, so says the article. Sounds like a good idea, unless you don't like paying for salt water. And also, pork is really good. Go to Heritage Foods USA. Yes, it's much more expensive. But yes, it's 20 times better. Eat pork less often. And
people don't realize a 3-ounce serving of pork could add as much as 400 milligrams of salt. Okay, that's a lot of salt from a shaker. You would never put that much salt on your pork.
Right, and you don't realize that it's salt. Anyway, so our friends at Heritage Foods, you can go and buy some real. Always get all natural pork, but if you go to Heritage Breeds Pork, Heritage Breeds of pork that's raised locally on family farms, you're going to get a better product. We have a wild boar on the menu at Stage Left.
So good.
That knocks people off their chair.
So good.
And it's just, it's a natural.
And it's pig. Red. It's red. Yeah, okay. Red it looks meat. Like, it looks like a lamb chop, except it's bigger.
Yeah.
It's red.
Delicious. All right. I got a little trashy news for us.
Trashy news.
TGI Fridays. When the kitchen manager at the TGI Fridays in College Mall in Bloomington, Indiana, accidentally cut his finger, severing a small part of it on April 25th, fellow workers rushed to his aid, but somehow in that chaos, a piece of that severed digit ended up in a hamburger that was served to a customer soon after the
incident. Why'd you have to go there? Enhanced beef we're talking about now. Why'd you have to go there?
Yikes. The Associated Press reports the customer spotted the piece of human flesh immediately and did not consume it. Good.
So good morning, everybody. Did you enjoy your Cheerios? Was that good? Are you guys ready to go now?
Amy Freshwater, a spokesman for the popular chain, told the AP, "We absolutely acknowledge the seriousness of this incident." Yes. Yes, ma'am. Involuntary cannibalism is a bad thing.
You know what? I'm going to go with voluntary cannibalism is also a bad thing.
Okay. But if you make me do it and I don't want to. Anyway, the problem was, until he was in the hospital emergency room, the injured kitchen manager didn't realize that he lost a small part of his finger. Freshwater said the restaurant's been in contact with a customer who had called the police about the incident. He was informed that it was not a criminal matter. I guess as long as the finger was not surreptitiously taken.
No. So you're saying if it had been in Jersey, that maybe
right.
It would have been.
If they weren't trying to teach the kitchen manager a lesson. Then it would have been a matter for the police. Foie gras ban.
We got to talk about the foie gras ban in Chicago.
Foie gras ban. The
it's
city
just one of those
Chicago
things.
Has banned the sale or service of foie gras.
You know what's upsetting about this? I know that Charlie.
Foie gras is the fattened liver of a duck. It's been in Western European cuisine for a long time. And animal rights idiots who don't know anything about, and I believe in animal rights. You've heard us do shows on humane methods of animal husbandry. But foie gras ducks lead a pretty good life.
Okay. We had Charlie Trotter on this show. Charlie Trotter is one of the leaders of the I don't want to serve foie gras on my menu. And that captured the headlines, okay, because he decided he didn't want to serve foie gras on his menu. But Charlie Trotter's been on this show where he told you, our audience, that he does not support a foie gras ban.
Right.
Okay. And we've told you a million times. Why would you have a foie gras ban when the chicken that large agribusiness is serving you is treated much less humanely than the ducks for foie gras? You should outlaw chicken made at these factory farms long before you outlaw foie gras.
Absolutely.
Long before.
If I had to come back as either a foie gras duck or a McDonald's chicken, I'll come back as a foie gras duck. And listen, it sounds unnatural because you don't know anything about animals, because you don't know anything about farming, to force, do they call it force feed a duck? Advocates call it hand feeding a duck. You know,
right.
It's pro-choice, pro-life. It's all charged language, right? So the way that it works with a duck, though, is a duck naturally gorges itself before it goes on
before
a long migration.
The Egyptians learned this a long time ago.
And what they would do is they'd go and try and capture the ducks that were gorging themselves before they took off. What foie gras does is it takes these ducks and it treats them very humanely. To have great liver, which is a high-end product, you've got to have a normal method of care for these ducks, and they're not abused. And you hand feed them, and yes, you can tamp down cornmeal down their throat, but they love it, okay?
Right, they run to the person who's about to feed them.
So
they blow a horn at the farm, and the ducks run to the person who's going to feed them.
So the foie gras ban is a feel-good, do-nothing measure by a bunch of toadies who don't know anything about animals. And we're going to have Rick Tremonto from Chicago, who's been on the show before. He's going to come on the show again and talk to us because his restaurant's in Chicago, and him selling foie gras on his menu is going to be illegal in about 90 days, and that's just crazy. We'll talk to him about that a little bit later on. We have a different guest coming on the show. Tom Colicchio from New York will be joining us in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back at the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurant. We have coming up later in the show Tom Colicchio, who is the head chef and judge on Bravo's reality series Top Chef. He's also a great chef in his own right in Manhattan. We've dined a number of times at his place. But we were talking about the foie gras, and we're going to have Rick Tremonto come on the show next week to talk about the fact that the city of Chicago, where his famous restaurant is, has banned the sale of foie gras. How crazy is that?
Yeah, I mean, you guys have heard us talk about it on a couple of different occasions, but we've gotten to a point now where you're telling people that they can't sell this product, which is available, which is being made, and that you can't sell it in a restaurant to people who want it.
Here's how foie gras is made, and you really need to know this. Mm-hmm. Foie gras ducks are kept on a farm, a traditional family farm usually, all right? Not always, but usually. In the United States, almost always. It's a place where these ducks can go outside, which Purdue chickens can't do.
Right.
McDonald's
period.
Chickens can't do. They can run. They're kept in a pen. I think they're kept 12 to a pen, something like that, out in the open like a duck should be. And what happens when it comes time to fatten the liver of the duck? The farmer goes up to the duck. And, yes, the farmer has to sort of chase the duck the first time or the second time.
Correct.
The duck's like, hey, what are you going to do to me?
But you're a farmer. You're a man.
Right. But then, why you grab my neck? But then the duck says, hey, that's cool. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
And like Mark said, you blow a horn and the ducks run to the person because they want to get fed like this. And what they do is they take a tube and they put it down a duck's neck. Now, that sounds cruel.
It sounds cruel.
Except that a duck's neck is calcified. It's not used to eating things that would not be good in your neck that are fine in the duck's neck. So the ducks don't mind. And they gently tamp down some cornmeal, some corn mash. And these ducks get fat. And their livers get enlarged. They can be three and four times the size of a duck's regular liver. Listen, you could give the duck junk food, sit it on a couch, and turn on its favorite TV program. Same thing's happening to you, Mark.
That's not funny. I think that also people tend to, when they think of foie gras, they think of the ancient ways of making foie gras that they used to do in France. Which was indeed inhumane.
Because they would staple the duck's
feet. They would staple the duck's
feet so it can't move.
So it couldn't move, and the duck would have to stay in one place its whole life.
Now, they don't do that anymore.
And they don't do that anymore. And I do think that was inhumane. And I would have a problem with that. And if you told me that we can't do that anymore, I'd say good.
Right, I agree. And we can't and we don't. So that's how foie gras is made. Now these ducks have a liver. Now the animal rights people say, oh, well, the ducks have a diseased liver.
Mm-hmm.
So what? They're not going to live long anyway. You know what I mean? It's not like they're in pain.
And
they're
again,
not in pain.
This is something that ducks do naturally before they migrate.
And we do it a little bit. They do it
Of course, we exaggerate it. But it was the ancient Egyptians who first noticed that ducks do this. They will gorge themselves. They will eat and eat and eat in order to get ready for migration. And what happens when they eat and eat and eat in order to get ready for migration is their livers engorge. Their livers get larger.
And you know what else they get? Yummier.
Right. But their liver goes back to normal during migration as they fly thousands of miles and don't land the storehouses in their body.
Of fat, which
but
is flavor.
Our idea is to eat them first
before
they use up the storehouses so we can have the storehouses.
All right, now here's the deal. Here's the disingenuousness of the animal rights people. And there are people who believe you should never kill animals for food.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? A person says, I don't believe you should kill any animal for food because the animals have as many rights as we have. You know what? That's an internally consistent position.
Right.
But if you admit that it's okay to kill animals for food, And then there are those that, kill animals for food. I don't care how you treat them. I don't care what it does to the planet. I don't care. They're food. They're protein machines. Grow them. Eat them. That's it. Okay. That's a viable position. A despicable but viable position as well. But where most people fall is, yes, it's okay to grow animals for food, but no, it's not okay to torture those animals and make them lead a terrible, unnatural life. Okay.
Okay, here's the problem. We're actually doing that to most of the animals that we eat in this country.
So posit this: you have a chicken that's raised for McDonald's or Purdue, and that chicken has its beak cut off, is pumped full of antibiotics and hormones, is put in a cage in the dark where it's never touched by a human being, can't turn around, has its feathers plucked from it,
and where it would peck the eyes out of the chicken next to it if it hadn't been
because it's so miserable. And that's okay. That's legal in Chicago. You can go get your chicken McNuggets. But foie gras, with the life that I just explained to you, that a foie gras duck lives, you can't go get your foie gras in Chicago, and it's just hypocritical. That's all.
That's what
I'm saying.
It's
We've done shows on humane methods of animal husbandry. I've seen how these foie gras ducks are raised. There's nothing wrong with it. I've seen how McDonald's chickens are raised. There is something wrong with that.
Right.
And I think that the animal rights people who if they really cared. Instead of going for the low-hanging fruit.
But you can't do that. You're talking about, when you talk about going after the foie gras farmer, what are there, three or four in North America, foie gras farmers?
Exactly, three.
Okay. They are, you know, small farmers.
Michael Gienor.
They can't fight this kind of legislation. They can't fight this kind of pressure. They don't have the economic wherewithal to do that.
But you know what?
But McDonald's sure as heck could. Okay, so why go after McDonald's? You can't. Okay, because you're not, because you don't have enough money and you're not strong enough.
But here's where I say the animal rights people who get behind this are morally bankrupt and betray their cause, because they're being disingenuous by picking mm-hmm. on this and saying, oh well, it's just we're looking for cruel ways that animals are treated to pick on that, because they're not, because they're going after operations that in North America, at least, and in most of the world, are family farms,
right.
Are treating their animals humanely, are not using antibiotics and steroids in their animals, are not, you know, making their animals lead an unnatural life in any way, yet they'll go after this, which just says they're saying we're trying to be reasonable, but what they're really doing is these people want to see no animals killed for meat. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And what the politicians are doing are saying, you know what, I can do this and look like I'm doing something about the horrible way that animals are treated in this country and the way that our food is produced, and not really have any.
You can't really
out.
Say that though, because the mayor of Chicago said, "Why are we wasting our time on this?" Mayor Daley said, "I can't believe we're spending time on this."
Rick Tramonto coming on the show next week to talk to us about that. We're gonna have Tom Colicchio after the break to talk to us about happier subjects here in New York, where you can eat foie gras to your heart's content. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and stage left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, back at the Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Shot of Stage Left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Tom Colicchio. He is the co-owner, founder, and executive chef of one of our favorite restaurants in New York City, Gramercy Tavern, as well as the Kraft restaurants, Kraft Bar, Witchcraft, and Kraft Steak. He's the recipient of five James Beard Awards. His cookbooks are Think Like a Chef and Kraft Cooking, and he's the head chef and judge on Bravo's reality TV cooking show, The Only One That We Like. Hey, Tom, welcome to the show.
How you doing?
We're doing very well. You know, Tom, when we opened our second restaurant, mm-hmm. we spent about 2 weeks running reruns on this show.
Okay.
You're opening a restaurant tonight, Kraft Steak in New York City. What are you doing talking to us?
What are you, nuts?
I had a late night there last night with just some, you know, family and friends, and we really the wheels kind of came off, so I was there pretty late last night, and I'm going to head over to the restaurant in about an hour or so.
Great.
Well,
it's
great. Great compliment to us that you came on the show.
Thanks.
Can we talk about your show on TV, Top Chef?
Sure, of course.
That is
the only thing I can't talk about is who won.
I know. Yeah,
fair enough.
We're not gonna. We're fans, though. And I'll tell you, I don't own a TV, to be honest with you. I'm not a big fan of TV, and we hate most reality cooking shows. But I go over Mark's house to watch yours. You want now? This is. Do you think? And you've watched the other reality cooking shows, I'm assuming. Yours seems
no,
much.
I haven't.
Oh, you haven't?
No, I haven't.
Oh, they're terrible.
You know, it's funny because I get interviewed now, and people say, "What other reality shows do you watch?" And I don't. I'm not much of a TV guy, and when mm-hmm. I do watch it, it's usually HBO.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I'm a movie guy myself, but Gordon Ramsay had a show. I don't know if you know about that one.
Oh, Kitchen, yeah. I saw it for about 2 minutes and watched him rip somebody apart and decided that, you know.
I want to go punch him.
Yeah. we did not. I'll tell you, I'm surprised, and I think that your show is really, really good, and Francis and I have not said good things about the other restaurant reality television shows, although, again, I've never seen an episode of Survivor. I don't watch very much reality TV.
Right.
But I did watch Rocco in the restaurant. A couple of our former employees were employees there, so we had our curiosity was piqued.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you, the way the producers put that together, we felt that they really made Rocco not look very good in that show.
We thought they were unfair to him.
We thought they were unfair to him. And was that a concern for you, that people would put it together and make you not look good?
It was a concern. It's very funny. Rocco's a good friend of mine, and I kind of promised him that I wouldn't compare what he did on his show to what we're doing, because it's different shows.
Of course.
But since you brought it up, and I think it was unfair. And I was concerned, and in fact, that was my major concern, with any reality show, is that you're going to be made to look foolish. Well, I got a pretty good sense from the producers that they had no desire to make me look foolish at all. In fact, quite the opposite. They wanted to make sure that I was the authoritative voice.
Yeah, you're pretty studly. You're pretty studly. I saw you balling out that Irish guy. It was pretty good. I like that.
he was just a little out of line there.
Yeah,
no, he was a lot out of line. Everybody was on your side.
Don't see off camera.
Hold on, actually. Right? Tom, we're going to take a break for the news. We'll come back and we'll talk more with Tom Colicchio, co-owner and founder and executive chef of Gramercy Tavern and head chef and judge on Bravo's reality cooking show Top Chef, after the news.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Tom Colicchio is the co-owner and executive chef of Gramercy Tavern, one of our favorite restaurants in Manhattan, and the Kraft Group of restaurants. He's got 5 James Beard Awards to his name. He's got 2 cookbooks, and he's the head chef and judge of Bravo's reality cooking show, Top Chef. We were talking before the break about how they really set you up as an authority figure on the show, and I think, Tom, one of the things that makes the show work is not only are there culinary professionals on the show, not only are there real prizes on the show, but you sort of do occupy the position of mentor chef, like an executive chef would in a restaurant group.
Right. Unfortunately, I'm in that dual role that I play. There's a limit to what I can do as far as mentor. I'm allowed to ask questions, but I can't tell them to do specific things.
Mm-hmm.
They feel that if they take my advice, then I'd sort of be biased towards them when I judge.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of off-camera stuff that I'm just asking questions and trying to get them to sort of look at what they're doing a different way. But it's hard because that is my role in my restaurants to give advice and to jump in. And so, a lot of times I'm sitting there going, God, just do this. and I can't say it.
Do you ever find that it worked? Because I saw when we were talking about, again, in the first episode, the first guy eliminated was an Irish fella who was a little testy and didn't really have a clear idea of the authority lines in the kitchen. And he sort of blew up at Hubert Keller and asked all sorts of inappropriate questions. It was getting out of line. And what I saw was a different side of being the chef, where you in your kitchen normally would have said, get out of my kitchen, you. And you showed a lot of restraint because, it was on the show. How did you react to that guy?
Well, it was really out of left field. I mean, I think a lot of people assume that reality TV is just set up.
Mm-hmm.
This happened. This just completely happened out of left field. At the end of the evening, we were just kind of going over, we're going to see you tomorrow, whatever, and Hubert just said, everybody enjoyed their time in the kitchen, and he just said, well, I didn't spend any time in your kitchen, so he threw me out after 1 minute. Well, he stuck his finger in the sauce and then put it back into his mouth and stuck his finger back in the sauce, which is, I think it's unsanitary. And, it's the kind of thing that happened 20 years ago in kitchens.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And I think that, we're all trying to clean up our industry and do things right, and especially nowadays, people are concerned with all kinds of diseases and things out there, and so he got called on it, and he just said, "This is what I do, and this is how I do it," and just really ripped into the chef. And Hubert was just really, and I've known Hubert for years, and he was really taken aback and just kind of was flustered for a second. And I think partly he was in front of the camera, so he didn't really know how to respond to it.
Right.
And I had at a certain point, I had to jump in and say something. I couldn't throw him off the set.
Right.
But
right.
What happened is right after that, the cameras cut, and it kind of got heated there, so person came over to me and started dabbing makeup on my forehead. And he says something like, "Why don't you get a wig for his head, too?" I was like, "Dude, I don't even know you." The first time I met the guy was during that episode. I was like, hey. He's like, "Come on."
Yeah, you know, it's funny.
A good thing, we got a sense, it was funny because there were some questions as to whether or not he was the worst up there, and there were two others that were pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the way we judge this, he had 20 years experience. The other two who were up there, one of them was a student, and the other one was a healthy food cook who was really, these two were really putting their heart and soul into it, and this other guy with 20 years experience just really didn't care.
Yeah.
And to me, I'd rather take the person who cares and who maybe has less experience and then... somebody who really just doesn't want to be there. So it was a pretty easy decision, I think. And we were given the latitude to make that kind of decision.
I'm going to tell you when I decided that I was going to like the show, and it was when you voted him off, because I said, A, this guy's a jerk, and you're voting him off, and he deserves to be voted off. But B, probably for as far as the show goes, it probably would have been entertaining television to have him stay on the show and continue to be this obnoxious jerk that he was.
Well, sure, and I think that's kind of really what things that I asked the production team before we started was, what kind of integrity are we going to have here, and is this something that you're going to tell us how to judge this or tell us who's going to win? They said, absolutely not. They consulted with us. They wanted to know before we told them. They just wanted to, make sure for legal reasons that it was the right decision, because there's some legal issues every time we make a decision.
Right.
And but no, they kind of gave us free hand to make those decisions.
The other thing about that is that I think is very interesting. You talk about how our industry's changed, and I think it was well documented in ways that people in the business don't realize. You read Kitchen Confidential. There was a time when not only his unsanitary practice was acceptable in kitchens, but where just being a jerk, as long as you could cook good food, was acceptable. And even if his food was pretty good, he's not a top chef. Who's going to follow him? Who's going to work for him? That's an important part of being a chef, don't you find?
Well, I think so. Yeah. Number one, unless you're going to, a lot of people's ideas about a kitchen is there's one guy back there, maybe with a dishwasher, doing everything, and it's not the case. We have a team of people. The gramercy on any given night, there are 20 people in the kitchen.
Right.
And so, unless you want to do everything yourself and have a 10-seat restaurant, you need to get people to sort of buy into your idea and your vision and work with you. And I don't think you can accomplish that anymore by browbeating people over the head.
Right.
I think you have to teach, you have to set, the proper example. I was promised myself, because I 25 years ago coming up in kitchens, I got kicked around a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I always promised myself that when I got in my kitchen, this wouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
I would really sort of take care of people, and it's served me well over the last 15 years since I've owned restaurants.
Well, now you're a pretty highly regarded chef, not just by us, but by the James Beard Foundation and the rest of the world. Now, what's different about this show, I think, and what I'm curious to see how you feel, is that in your kitchen, everyone is aspiring to be a kitchen professional, and everybody comes with some experience in it being a full-time job on the restaurant side of things. You're in this situation where you didn't get to interview these people and say, okay, you're not a likely candidate, you're not a likely candidate. You've got a 23-year-old student who has no restaurant experience. You've got people who have hotel experience. What's it like to have those different, vastly different skill sets working on food? What do you look for? I mean, is it possible for the 23-year-old student with no restaurant line experience to do well in this kind of environment?
I don't think she could have won. And there are students that were maybe better who could have competed and probably sort of hung in there a little longer.
Mm-hmm.
But what the producers wanted to do was sort of show the public that there's more to cooking than just a restaurant. you know, there are people in the catering business. There are private chefs. There are institutional chefs. There's and there's chefs that need to be institutionalized. But there's all different sort of facets of what we do, and I think they wanted to show that.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to me when the show started that there were three or four candidates, and it seems like those seem to be the people that have made it towards the end of the show who were stronger than the other people.
Right.
Did you feel that same way?
I did, and what was interesting is in the first challenge when they had to present their signature dish,
mm-hmm.
It was completely random as to who presented first. And it just happened that the first six were really weak,
mm-hmm.
and the second six were pretty strong. And after the first six, when we saw their food, the judges, we just looked at each other and went, oh, my God, if this is what it's going to be like, we're in for a long, for 4 weeks of filming.
Right.
And but luckily, the second six were much stronger. But I think that, and I can't get too much away, but there are some circumstances that kind of push people who maybe weren't the best sort of a little further along because of some of the team challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, our guest today is Tom Colicchio. He's co-owner and founder of Gramercy Tavern and the Craft Restaurants. He's head chef and judge on Bravo's reality cooking show, Top Chef. You can link to it from our site, restaurantguysradio.com. And we're going to talk more with him in just a moment when we come back. And I want to talk about craft restaurants because that's a very unique concept, and that's another great restaurant that you're running. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest is Tom Colicchio, head chef and judge on the reality cooking series Top Chef, but he also has Gramercy Tavern in New York and the Craft Restaurants, and you're opening Craft Steak tonight. I remember when Kraft first opened, and I went there a number of times early on. That's a very unique concept of restaurants. Can we talk about that at all?
Sure, of course.
What drove you to open Kraft, and what was the guiding principle when you opened it, and how was it initially received? And
sure, I'll try to give you the quick story.
Well, 6.5 minutes is what we do.
Gramercy Tavern's right around the corner,
uh-huh.
and I had the opportunity to open a restaurant, the second restaurant, and I couldn't do the food that I was doing at Gramercy. And so what I did is I looked at what I had been doing, at Gramercy for the 8 years that had been open, and realized that every year I would take my repertoire of dishes and every year just remove things. I think what happened is I got older, I was more confident, and I didn't have to rely on the bells and whistles. And so when it came time to do a new restaurant and a new menu, I thought, well, what would happen 15 years from now? How would the food look? And I thought that it would be just completely clean and absolutely naked, where it would only be about the particular protein or vegetable or mushroom that I was interested in cooking, as opposed to creating a dish from five ingredients, say. And, that whole idea of cooking being a craft, not so much an art, and obviously it can be elevated to an art form, but I was more interested in the craft of cooking. And that's why I decided to do that, and that's how the name came about.
And when it originally came out, it was just everything was very sparse, and you could sort of put your own meal together. Now, you tempered that a little bit.
It's interesting. That was never the case. When you say put your own meal together, I think a lot of people thought that they were going to order a piece of fish and order some vegetables, and it was all going to come together on one plate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that was never the case. Everything was served on the table, sort of family style.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting is I never thought it was that unique because we had that paradigm in a steakhouse.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or in a Chinese restaurant, for instance, where things were served at the table. But it was funny when I would talk to journalists about that, it would come out that I was opening a Chinese restaurant. I was opening, you know, a steakhouse. And, yeah, it was bizarre. And what was really interesting is, you know, Kraft opened, and 2 years later, Kraft Steak opened in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you'd think that, you know, these sophisticated New Yorkers would completely get it, and these, you know, people in Las Vegas who are flying in from God knows where would just completely not get. They completely got it in Las Vegas because it was a steakhouse.
Right.
And so it was, you know, it just showed me that it was really about packaging this.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we got better. We sort of understood, you know, the anxiety the customer was having in New York, and we figured out ways around it and figured out ways to make it work. And we also, the menu when we first opened was somewhat complicated the way it was laid out, and we realized that we needed to change that. And so it's still the same restaurant. We really haven't changed anything except that we package it slightly different.
I have to say, I went there early, and I still go there occasionally, and I really do enjoy it. But I do like that you streamline the menu down a little bit, but mm-hmm. you have an amazing wine list there. And with all of those individual ingredients, you can go and, you know, may have yourself a little food adventure of your own choosing.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think, you know, in a way, it's very difficult to pair wine in restaurants these days because you always have to worry about the mango salsa relish chutney that someone's sneaking on the lamb,
uh-huh.
and you're thinking you're going to get, you know, this great roast lamb with herbs and you know, great California Cabernet or something, and all of a sudden this acid bomb kind of sneaks in there.
Right. Cilantro mango.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm nothing against that stuff. I love it, but, you know, I'd rather have it with a Corona.
Right.
You know, I think it's a great environment to really enjoy wine and pair wine with food.
That's awesome. Tom, you know that I was reading through your bio last week, and as I'm reading through it, I couldn't help but laugh because in the late 80s, you and I seem to have got our restaurant beginning at the same restaurant.
Which one?
Well, I was at Evelyn's in Somerville.
Oh, my God.
You were
at Evelyn's?
I was at Evelyn's Seafood Restaurant.
Oh.
I graduated high school in 1980. So in 1980, actually, I was working there probably in 1978 because I started in the front of the house.
Uh-huh.
As soon as I graduated high school, I took the summer off and kind of.
Can I tell you that we owe Evelyn's, which is now out of business, a great debt of gratitude because, and I didn't work there. I would just occasionally visit Mark at the bar there, and we learned how not to do everything.
I swear, people will ask me.
I had a guy who worked there. His name was Slim,
uh-huh.
and Slim was probably in his 60s. Uh-huh. He's an old black gentleman from down south who really could cook.
Mm-hmm.
However, they wouldn't let him.
Oh, you know? Yeah.
But he would kind of take that recipe book and kind of push it aside, and he would do things that were really great. And so I actually learned a lot from him.
There was nobody that liked that at Mark's.
Exactly. I learned a lot of everything that you should do to stop your restaurant from dying is what I learned.
There was an old guy who used to bartend right before Mark as well, and Mark used to have to melt the ice every time before he'd go in because the guy believed in recycling ice that we used was used
very
for mixed
nice.
Drinks. So he'd like make a martini in a shaker and then pour the martini out and then put the ginned up ice back in and use it again.
Into the ice
fewer trips to the ice machine.
Well,
only
he was just making flavored ice cubes.
Only, you know, the only problem was he really was because there was a lady who used to drink Stingers in the morning.
Uh-huh.
Everything had a certain minty twing to it in the afternoon. It was kind of lovely.
You know, but it was a lot easier back then, wasn't it?
Yeah, it sure was. You know, your concept with Kraft, though, I think is very interesting. And when people talk about, because we get emails from all over the world and people ask all kinds of crazy things, but when they talk about green markets, we're very about seasonal, local, sustainable agriculture, small producers. And when people cook at home, I really, rather than the whole big orchestrated dinner at home, I think that's a great way for people to cook at home, even for parties. If you can go to the green market and find something that's seasonal, find one or two things and just cook them.
Right.
You know what I mean? And, I mean, do you think that's good advice for people to follow at home?
You know, it is, and I talk a lot about that in my book, Think Like a Chef, that, you know, don't sort of be bound up by recipes and you have to go, you know, take your recipe and you go to the market and, oh, my God, you can't find, you know, one particular ingredient, so what do you do? Learn how to cook a few things and keep it simple. You know, it was another reason I decided to do what I did at Kraft was that in New York, very few people are cooking at home. They're either doing takeout or going to restaurants. And the idea of passing food around the table was missing.
Nice.
I mean, when I have a dinner party, I never plate food at home. Everything's just put on the table.
Sure. Right. Here's more advice for people out there. Sometimes I'll plate a course, but usually it's not. It's family style. If there are a bunch of wines, in all but the rarest of occasions, I'll open every wine and let people go. You know, I don't do it in order. You know, grab. You know, that's
right,
the whole thing of drinking at home. Yeah. Hey, listen, I want to touch on the topic, and then we can finish it after the break. But what if restaurants and home cooking is going toward these wanting beautiful ingredient thing? How does that compare with what's going on with people who are really embracing technology, like Ferran Adrià or David Birch Flavor Spray or Wally Dufresne's cooking with menthol crystals? How does that relate?
You know, I think there's
because I don't like it.
Well, see, I don't dislike it.
Okay.
And I said that very carefully because I think there's a place for it.
Yes.
I think what Ferran does is wonderful. I think what Wiley does is wonderful. There's a place for it. And I just think that you have to go into the restaurants with your eyes wide open and sort of understand that you're going into an experimental place. You know, it's you know, the difference between going to see, you know, a rock show and then sitting down and listening to John McLaughlin play jazz.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you know going in what you're going to get.
Right.
And I think it's important. I think it'd be very foolish for a home cook to start doing that.
I agree. And to go and do it as a one-off thing, to do it once in a blue moon, I really do like it, and I enjoy it as an experiment. But it's
not the way I want to eat all the time.
I hope it's not the future of food.
I don't think it is.
All right. When we come back, we're going to talk more with Tom Colicchio. He's the co-owner and executive chef of Gramercy Tavern, the craft restaurants, and he's head chef and judge on Bravo's cooking show, Top Chefs. We'll be talking more with him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, you're back with The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Cafe Lombardi and Stage Left Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest is Tom Colicchio. Tom, I want to talk about Gramercy Tavern because it's sort of, at the opposite end of the spectrum of, you know, experimental, you know, high-design food. Gramercy Tavern forever has been like home to me. I mean, I have friends who come in from Europe or winemaker friends who come in from all over the world, and we punctuate every visit with on the way to the plane, we stop and have dinner at your place, and you've been responsible for many missed flights.
No matter who it is who asks me about what my top five restaurants are in Manhattan, no matter what kind of experience they're looking for, Gramercy's always on that list when I'm talking to recommending restaurants to people.
What's your mission at Gramercy, man?
The mission, you know, Danny Meyer, my partner there, he and I, when we got together to discuss whether or not we were going to work together, we really spent a lot of time not talking so much about food or service. We really spent the time talking about what was missing from the restaurant, from restaurants as we saw it. Mm-hmm. And we had a very similar starting point as far as what, you know, our taste level. And we actually, you know, took a week and traveled through Italy and came back and, you know, decided that we were going to work together. And I think that, you know, the mission there was to do everything as correct as possible, but to do it in a casual, you know, relaxed environment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I guess we accomplished that. I mean, it's been 12 years now, and it's busier than ever. And you're right, it feels like home, and that's kind of what we wanted to do.
You know, it's the kind of place I like. I've been to private wine tastings in your private room. I've been there on dates and had a great time. I've sat at your bar, and I took my 82-year-old dad there for lunch 2 weeks ago. You know, and it's perfect. You really hit the hospitality mark on the head.
Thanks.
Anyway, I want to thank you for taking the time to join us on the Restaurant Guys, especially as you're opening a restaurant tonight. Craft Steak opens tonight to the public?
Yep, it's open tonight.
Wow.
So we're opening in around 5 hours.
You're nuts. You know what? Maybe Mark and I will stop by there tonight for dinner. You never know.
I'll be there all night.
I'm sure you will, and you won't have time to talk to us.
Well, you know, actually tonight what we do quickly is you know, we kind of opened 3 nights ago to family and friends, 75, the next night 90, last night 160. Tonight we're only going to do about 90 covers.
Uh-huh.
So we'll cap it off because I feel that the 90 people who do come in opening night, they should get a great experience, not some crazed out, you know, wacky thing that happens when chefs open restaurants.
When restaurants open.
We completely understand.
You want to keep all the wacky in the restaurant reality show, not actually in your real restaurant.
Exactly. Even the cash register's open, it needs to be right. Last night we kind of pushed it and, yeah, it was wild.
And you're supposed to push it during friends and family.
Exactly,
that's part of the deal.
Yeah.
And as you, it's funny, friends and family is when you invite your friends and family and you don't charge them or you charge them very little. And we did that recently. We opened a restaurant recently in New Brunswick. And my family, the first time they came to friends and family, and I walked up to my cousins and the waiter walked over and said, "Hi, welcome to Catherine Lombardi. You'll be having the spaghetti and you'll be having the... Hi, may I tell you what your order is?"
That's a good concept, though, huh?
Oh, it's great. Because we wanted to order off the menu broadly, so we tested every station.
Right.
So
exactly.
You were getting what you were getting.
I know exactly what you're talking about, sure.
And what we said to people was, we said, and if you don't like what you're having, you can switch it with your friend. Trading is
someone will trade.
Hey, man, good luck tonight with everything.
Thanks a lot, guys.
That's great. Thanks very much.
Take care.
Tom Colicchio from the Gramercy Tavern, Craft Steak. He's got two cookbooks and his life and his show on the Bravo Network, Head Chef, is still going. And Top Chef? What did I say?
You said Head Chef.
Whatever. He's the Head Chef at Top Chef. And we tune in every week. It's the only show that I watch that's like that. Anyway, you can link to all that on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to the Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.